We're happy to hear argument in our first case, Liberty Wood Nursing Center versus Sebelius. Mr. Biancalli.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. I am Joseph Biancalli. I'm counsel to the petitioner, Liberty Wood Nursing Center. Pleased to be back here. Your Honors, 12 years ago, the Supreme Court decided a case called Christensen versus Harris County. Received little notice then or since. But it included a very pointed discussion of the degree to which courts should defer to agency decision-making that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Christensen involved whether the Fair Labor Standards Act permitted a local government to force sheriff's deputies to take mandatory comp time rather than paying cash for overtime. You know, obscure question. There was no statute or regulation on point. So the Labor Department argued that the court should defer to its application of various general regulations under the traditional standard of deference of Chevron. That's essentially what the Secretary is asking you to do here. In this case, she says she has a general regulation that requires facilities to supervise residents to prevent accidents. She says the court should defer to its interpretation of that regulation to require interventions such as men's groups or telemedicine consultations or even consideration of chemical castration where a demented elderly man misbehaves in a way that a surveyor finds offensive. But that's just what Christensen rejected. It held that Chevron deference is due only in two circumstances. First, where an agency is promulgating regulations under the notice and comment provision of the APA, the Administrative Procedure Act, or when it's clarifying an ambiguous regulation that admits of two possible interpretations. Neither of those is the case here. Here, the speculative nature of the Secretary's recommendations suggests that she's unhappy about this particular resident's behavior, but she really doesn't have a very good idea what to do about it. And I would suggest to you, and petitioner would suggest to you, that unhappiness about a resident's condition or a resident's behavior is not a regulatory criterion for imposing sanctions. In this case, the record contains no evidence at all, none, that anyone who was involved in the case on behalf of the Secretary, not the State Survey Agency, not CMS, not the ALJ, or not the Secretary's Appeals Board, had any expertise at all in the assessment and treatment of dementia or behaviors triggered by dementia.
Is that required for them to determine whether the nursing home was in substantial compliance or not?
How do you apply the regulation that the board itself said incorporates a rule of reason unless you can make judgments that particular interventions or lack of interventions meet or fail to meet a standard of care? I mean, if the agency, right, says in its decision, we don't have to look at that evidence. They say we are not bound by any medical standard of care. We do not have to defer to the medical decision-making by the people who are bound to do that. We can make a decision and impose sanctions on a completely subjective basis. Then we have a problem. And we would suggest that it's circumstances like this why a number of court of appeals now are taking a much closer look at board decisions that are not well-reasoned. For example, just in the last few weeks, the Sixth Circuit set aside a board decision where the agency and the board couldn't explain how the same regulation at issue here applied to a particular set of facts in that case. That's a case called Cal Turner Extended Care Pavilion. It was decided in October. A couple months before that, the D.C. Circuit has just set aside a board decision where under Section 706-2A of the Administrative Procedure Act, which is an interesting way to do it, where they found that the board's inability to explain the reasoning for its action in that case for imposing a sanction greater than it usually did was arbitrary and capricious, and they sent that one back. And again, that's what happened here, and we'll explain why in a minute. We've noted a number of those other cases that are now starting to give a little bit closer scrutiny to the board's reasoning, where they're applying general regulations, where there is a substantial question whether the facility staff could have been on notice of the specific interventions that the board is now saying that they should have done, where they are not consistent with the standard of care, not consistent with the nursing's training, not set forth in any program manual, regulation, interpretive guideline, et cetera.
Well, they said that the board said that close supervision was required, and Liberty Wood's own witnesses addressed the appropriate compliance standard, didn't they?
That's right. They said, all right, they said that the focus, well, let me rephrase that a little bit or change the perspective a little bit. What the board said is essentially that the focus ought to be on the resident's behavior. So far, so good. Then they said, all right, but we don't have to give any weight to the testimony by the facility's witnesses that explained why they did what they did or why they didn't do what they didn't do. And our suggestion is that by focusing on just the resident's behavior and by not making a finding that what the facility staff did or didn't do was wrong, right? That's where our problem is. There's no evidence in the record, and in fact, there's no discussion in either the ALJ decision or the board decision that the facility staff actually did anything wrong. What they did was they say, well, CMS came in with, you know, this professor from Boston College who came up with a laundry list of other things that they might have considered. And so from that, we can infer that because the facility staff didn't think of the same things that this professor thought of, a professor, mind you, with no real expertise in the area of providing care to dementia residents, but they said we can infer from the fact that the facility staff didn't come up with the same things that this professor did that they didn't do everything within their power. And our argument throughout has been if the standard is to take reasonable steps, I mean, the board can't just start grasping out of the air things like, you know, well, you should have thought of men's groups, or you should have thought of different activities, or you should have thought of something different, up to and including, I mean, the fairly bizarre finding that they made as well, it's a violation of the regulation because the resident's physician didn't consider Depo-Provera or chemical castration because this fellow's, you know, behavior was so bad. I mean, context obviously matters. I mean, we are obviously not talking about sexual assaults, you know, in any meaningful sense here. I mean,
well,
we're talking.
We don't have documented sexual assaults, to be sure. We have whatever it was that was put down in the record by the nurses that you employed. Maybe you can tell me what Liberty Wood did after the September 6th incident.
All right. The resident gets admitted. A day or two later, he tries to get out. So they consult with the physician. He, you know, he changes medications and so forth. A week or 10 days later, he rolls up next to a resident, tries to grab her breast through her clothes.
Can we just go back to changing his medication? Is this similar to the drugs that you talked about being chemical castration?
Well, definitely.
So it's okay if you all give it, but it's not. I think your argument's a little difficult for me to grasp. When your people do whatever it is they're doing, they're acting reasonably. And when the secretary says that they should do more, she doesn't know anything.
Well, Dr. Beidel is the resident's attending physician. He is not an employer agent of the facility. He comes in and he gives orders that the facility has to follow. Right? Now, he testified that he was willing to go so far but no further.
Who is he paid by?
Assuming that the resident is a Medicare or Medicaid beneficiary, I think it's the resident's of the right age, he'd be paid by the resident's insurer. He's not paid by the facility. He's paid by the resident.
Who is the facility paid by?
I'm sorry?
Who is the facility paid by?
No, I don't.
The insurer as well, correct?
To be honest, Judge, I don't know whether the record indicates whether this resident.
No, but you said
Medicaid.
Assuming that the person is Medicare or Medicaid eligible, the doctor would be paid by the facility. If we make the same assumption,
no.
So would your client.
Assuming that the resident's Medicare or Medicaid eligible, the doctor would be paid by that program.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor's not paid by the facility, and he's not.
I didn't say that.
Okay.
If we take your assumption that Medicare or Medicaid pays for the doctor, it also would pay for your facility care, correct?
No, because the resident could not be paid for by Medicare because the
what about Medicaid?
if he qualified, he would have been paid by Medicaid. And I'm not sure the record indicates whether he was or he wasn't, whether he had private insurance, was paying for himself, or was paid for by Medicaid. We know he couldn't be Medicare because he came from another nursing home and not a hospital.
And Medicare, whoever it is, supplies this doctor, and your facility has no call on who they supply.
The typical means would be that physicians want to practice at the facility would have to get credentialed, and then the resident would choose the physician off that list. So in most cases, and again, I don't think the record says in this case, but in most cases, the facility would not designate the doctor. The resident would choose it. I think we can infer from the record that this physician had not taken care of this resident before, but sometimes that's the case and sometimes...
Well, I'm a little confused about that because it appears in the record that this Dr. Battelle, whatever his name is referred to as a medical director. And when he spoke to the state surveyors, his recommendation was that the only effective way of preventing resident two from inappropriately touching a female is one-on-one monitoring, which you didn't do until several weeks later.
What he said was that proved to be more effective than the other interventions. But remember, he had said when he first evaluated the resident that the resident appeared to require supervision, but not enough to go to a locked unit or something. As the resident started acting out and behaving badly, he changed his mind several weeks into the resident's stay. And so after several weeks, they did put him on one-to-one. It was progressive. Remember, responding to Judge Motz's question, first time he did something, they separated him. They told him not to do it again. They watched him. Now, even CMS's witnesses said that's appropriate for that kind of first acting out. Right? He did it again the same day. So then they called in Dr. Beidel. They supervised him more closely. Dr. Beidel said he saw him being supervised, seated at the nursing station. He didn't do anything for another 4 or 5 weeks after that. He didn't start up again until a month later. When he started up again, Dr. Beidel came in, participated in the care planning, and at that point he said he changed his mind, thought he required more supervision, and that's when they started one-to-one.
We can read the record, too, and a selective account of it is really not helpful. I mean, there are these other incidents. We're not clear if there was a touching, but there was an approach, and there is a note about incidents on the 8th, 15th, and 20th of September, too. Is there not?
Right. He was going toward and was redirected,
he doesn't do anything for another month is really not forthcoming with the court.
No, I think the point that Dr. Beidel was making and the nurses were making is these behaviors are not all that unusual. They are trained and equipped to take care of them. And to put them all into one bucket retrospectively after the incident where he went into the resident's room, and then to say, oh, look, all these things that happened for the 6 or 8 weeks before that suddenly get, we're going to retrospectively give them much more importance. I think what the facility staff is saying, that's not reasonable because we deal with behaviors by demented residents all the time, and you can't predict all the time what they're going to do. The Crestview Acres case that we talked about, I think, is indicative of that, where the ALJ said if you're responding appropriately on an ongoing basis, that's all that the regulation requires.
Okay, I think we understand.
I'll reserve it. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Erin Scheer, and I represent the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. We're asking that you uphold the Secretary's final decision to sustain the civil money penalty. The Secretary's final decision is based on substantial evidence on the record as a whole. Libertywood did not comply with 42 CFR 483.25H when it did not take all reasonable measures to address Resident 2's foreseeable sexual behavior and to supervise and restrict his contact with vulnerable female residents. Resident 2, a male resident with dementia and known sexually inappropriate behaviors, was left to wander freely for about a 2-month period of time, targeting primarily cognitively impaired female residents. It was clear very early on, at least by September 6th, the two attacks on September 6th, that he required close monitoring, but he did not receive it. Liberty Witness own notes documented more than 10 incidents. There are four main reasons this court should uphold the CMP. Liberty Wood did not implement reasonable supervision and interventions by, one, implementing any close monitoring of Resident 2 until the incident on October 17, 2009. And on October 17, 2009, it was a 29-year-old woman with a neurological disease, but she was cognitively intact, and she was able to report the abuse to her family. A Liberty Wood nurse wrote that Resident 2 went into room 118, approached Resident 1, started fondling Resident 1 on the breast and touching her on the vagina. Resident 1 told Resident 2 she was married, she had a husband, don't do that, but Resident 2 continued. Resident 1 was unable to defend herself. And even after that, the close monitoring was started, the one-on-one supervision, it was not implemented properly, resulting on another attack on November 13th.
Well, isn't it true that that one-on-one supervision wasn't implemented until after the attack on November 13th, 2009?
It was not implemented properly. It was supposed to be one-on-one when he was out of bed, and what happened was they started it only when he was out of bed at 9 a.m., but they got him out of bed earlier than that for breakfast. So they brought him over to breakfast. We're not doing one-on-one supervision. And Liberty Wood wrote that at 7:50, he had his hand up Resident 6 shirt touching her breast. And so that's what happened. And then he was actually discharged to another facility with a secured unit on November 17th.
And then after he was discharged, why do the penalties extend to December 11th when the patient wasn't there between November 17th and December 11th?
The immediate jeopardy was stopped at the date that he was discharged. So instead of being $33,700, I believe, it went to $100 a day. And the reason for that was that the secretary held that the facility's problems went beyond the actions of one uncontrollable resident, that it had a systemic problem, including poor documentation, poor care planning, poor supervision, and behavior tracking records that were plainly false. And in its own plan of correction, Liberty Wood only asserted by December 11th it achieved compliance by doing in-service trainings, disciplining its staff for insufficient monitoring, incident accident reports were reviewed, and its admission practices were changed so that during admission they could review potential resident history.
I had that question too, but so the answer, to just pick up on the end of the answer, the December 11th date is a date in which Liberty asserts it's fully in compliance with all of these changes it had to make to its procedures. Is that correct?
Correctly, it is.
So it's
correct.
It's not, there's not a dispute about what that date was. In other words, Liberty doesn't say, oh, we were in compliance by December 1st.
Well, they presented no evidence that they
right.
were in compliance earlier than that.
Okay.
So there was basically four main reasons that we asked you to uphold. And the other reasons are that they did not follow their own behavioral monitoring program protocol. They did not make any coordinated plan according to Resident 2's assessments to keep them occupied during the day. They basically didn't have any interventions that were tailored to this resident. He had severe cognitive impairment, and interventions such as they assessed him immediately that he couldn't remember things after a few minutes. They would tell him not to do it again, redirection. They would have to be on him with one-on-one to possibly do any redirection. So anyways, Resident 2 was discharged on November 17th. The immediate jeopardy civil money penalty ended. And basically, these four reasons we ask that you uphold.
Do we know what has happened to this gentleman?
Yes, he was discharged.
I know that.
According to their records, he was discharged to another nursing home facility with a secured unit.
So he's locked in somewhere, is that it? Locked in some room?
I would hope not. I don't know the specifics, but usually when they say secured unit, they refer to it's I mean, it's a very small unit, and they were able to do a very intense supervision. But it's usually part of a nursing facility. But they did not have one of those here at Libertywood. So the Secretary's final decision is based on substantial evidence on the record as a whole. Do you have any other questions? If not, I guess I conclude my argument.
I think we understand your argument. Thank you.
Thanks.
Sir, do you have any rebuttal?
Just briefly, Your Honor.
Just address a couple of the things that came up, and then I'll sum up. In terms of the compliance date in December, the regulations require after a deficiency is cited that the facility files a plan of correction, and if they don't do that, then they will be terminated from the program immediately. So they have to do that, and the agency does not allow you to put in a compliance date earlier than the date of the survey. So they have no choice but to put down a date like that, whether they agree with it or not. Obviously, we didn't agree with it. We appealed the whole sanction and said that there were no systemic problems, and that to the extent that the concern was focused on the dealings with this particular resident, according to some of the other board cases we cited, right, that concern goes away once the resident goes away. The government never alleged in the statement of deficiencies that there was some problem with assessment or admissions or anything like that. That all came up in the course of the appeal as post hoc justification for what they had done. Secondly, one of the concerns that the caregivers have expressed throughout this case in their testimony, of course they were not allowed to testify live by the ALJ, but in their written testimony, is that much of the critique just was not consistent with what the current standard of care, including the regulatory requirements that are imposed on facilities by CMS for dealing with, you know, unfortunate residents who have dementia. These regulations, we're all bound by them, but they're 25 years old based on research that was done years before that, right? And much of the regulations just don't fit what the residents' facilities are like now. For example.
But didn't you just say you're bound by them?
We are bound by them. But the board itself has said in other cases that they're bound under a standard of reasonableness, that there's a rule of reason in these regulations, and the facility cannot be, you know, charged with, you know, with per se liability, et cetera, those kinds of things. So, for example, in their experts said, and the brief said, well, you should have isolated this fellow, should have separated him from females. Well, the regulations say you cannot isolate somebody. There's a disconnect there. You should have considered involuntarily medicating him. Well, the regulations say you can't involuntarily medicate him. You should have earlier considered discharging him involuntarily. Well, the regulations say you can't discharge him involuntarily. As a matter of fact, even during the course of the facility's efforts to discharge him, when they just said we cannot, you know, we don't want to expose ourselves to liability. Remember, this is a facility that had had a similar problem some years before when a hospital had dumped on them a violent younger resident that suffered a brain injury in a motorcycle accident who terrorized the place, and they couldn't get rid of him because the state wouldn't let them move. The state takes the position, it's your problem. And so they did progressively. Again, even CMS's witnesses said, I mean, you cannot consider involuntary discharge the first time somebody does something like this. You cannot consider, you know, involuntarily medicating the first time somebody does this. You cannot consider separation the first time somebody does this. So the regulation incorporates the notion that the caregivers have to exercise judgment. Where do they draw the lines? Now, if the standard is a surveyor can come in at the end of the story and look back and say, well, you should have exercised your judgment by drawing a line here on this date, that's an impossible standard. It's not consistent with the medical standard of care. It's not consistent with what the regulation says. It's not consistent with what the board has done in other cases. I mean, look at that Crestview case. Almost identical facts, except that the culmination of the resident's behaviors in that case was the actual rape of another resident. And the ALJ in that case, a different ALJ, had a different perspective, looks at it and says the facility did almost exactly the same sequence of interventions that occurred here. He said that's all you can reasonably do, and the facility can't be bound to, you know, to be clairvoyant, to predict that what this resident does tomorrow might be worse than what he's doing today. Right? You saw the testimony by the caregivers in this case. They use words like, well, the behavior by this resident was not particularly dramatic. Well,
on September 9th, they said it was increasingly aggressive sexual behaviors.
Correct. Increasingly aggressive. They put it in the care plan. They put him under close supervision, starts with 15-minute checks to know where his whereabouts is. Now, again, remember, this is a resident who's in a wheelchair, who's paralyzed on one side. So he's not roaming throughout the facility. He's not pouncing on residents. Right, he's paralyzed on one side. He's got one good hand. He's got Parkinson's, though. He can't stand. He can't walk by himself. Right, this is, sadly, a typical resident of a nursing facility. He is physically and mentally debilitated, and he behaves in ways that are consistent with his mental disabilities. And, again, you know, the choice is lock him up, as Judge Mott said, which is distasteful for everybody. He's not responsible for his behaviors. No evidence that he's even has the capability to hurt anyone, right? Or do the best you can in an open nursing facility where he's not going to be isolated. He's not going to be put in the equivalent of solitary confinement, right? Suggestion will give him more activities and things to do. He gets agitated in group settings. It's documented. He's paralyzed on one side. He can't focus for more than a few seconds. This is a very, very sad case, and you have the caregivers doing their best to explain, look, we weren't just hoping for the best. We were doing what we thought was appropriate for this fella, and then after the behavior escalated, when he did go into a resident's room, everything else was in the dining room or out in the open, then we did jump on it. We tried to discharge him. The state wouldn't let us. We tried to put him on one-to-one. We tried to discharge him to his daughter. His daughter wouldn't take him. We tried to get the family to send somebody in to sit with him. They wouldn't do it. And ultimately, they got the state to allow them to discharge him, as Judge Mott says, to a locked facility, which nobody likes. So the record shows this poor guy was in three different facilities plus the hospital within about a three-month period because nobody could do anything for him. Unfortunately, he was sitting in our chair when the music stopped, and here we are.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We will come down and greet the lawyers and then go directly to our second case.